Orleans. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. When composer and bandleader Aurora Neeland was a little girl, her mother told her she'd have to teach herself to play piano. So she did. She also learned oboe, flute, clarinet, accordion, saxophone, and many other instruments. Now she plays a range of styles, including experimental pop. But Neeland says she's not a natural performer.
I see performance even in my relationship to music as secondary to just being able to make music. You know, so I don't always necessarily like, I really want to perform. It's like, I really want to make this music. And it seems like performing is the way that it's going to get made.
Aurora Neeland, music maker, after the break. Like most people, Aurora Neeland has hair and teeth and bones and muscle, but the rest of her is sound. Rarely has an artist so thoroughly demonstrated musicality as a dominant human trait. Started life in California, playing oboe and flute, then expanded her repertoire to include soprano saxophone, clarinet, piano, accordion, trumpet, and at times, a metal staircase. She plays whatever style needs playing. Traditional jazz, experimental pop, rock and roll, Brazilian choros, punk, and electronica.
Fire in your heart.
She's a bandleader and a performance artist. She's a composer. She sings. And when the moment is right, she also dances. Before settling in New Orleans in 2004, Neeland studied at the Oberlin Conservatory in Ohio and L'École Internationale de Jacques Lecoq in Paris. She's released 5 albums that cover an extraordinary range of musical territory, from the songs of Sidney Bechet with her band The Royal Roses to avant-garde music she performs as The Monocle. She and pianist Tom McDermott also play cabaret.
It's now morning, low. My sweet man, I love him so. Though he's mean as can be. He's the kind of a man. He's the kind of a woman like me.
Aurora Neeland joins us at Marini Studios, and we're absolutely thrilled.
My pleasure.
You came to New Orleans in 2004, but you actually made, some years later, a spectacular kind of debut, you know,
sure.
At Preservation Hall.
Yeah.
You know, that's when you led your own band there,
yeah,
in this tribute to Sidney Bechet.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like, you know, like Muhammad Ali taking on Sonny Liston. You know what I mean? It's like, you're like a really young person at that time. You
yeah.
know what I mean? Sort of, you know what I mean? Attacking this giant.
Yeah, it was definitely, I remember it as a challenge that I gave myself. I had been here, you know, for, I can do math, 7 years at that point, and certainly had been listening to that music for quite a long time, and been playing with a lot of different ensembles and pickup bands around town. And I think it was, for me, really trying to wanting to give myself the challenge of music and looking at the arrangements and traditions. And sort of this sad thing that happens when you're a freelance artist is you find you won't do a lot of the things that you say you're going to do unless you book a concert or you
yes.
give yourself a deadline or you have a commission, you know? And so I sort of, for me, playing at Preservation Hall was equivalent of like playing at Carnegie Hall.
Yeah.
That was the first gig that the Royal Roses ever played. That was our first, that was how we became a band, was through
right.
learning that music and trying, and for me as a soprano saxophonist looking at Bechet's work, it was a good way to sort of like push myself to look at that work.
¶¶
the concert didn't seem like it was intended to replicate Bechet as much as it was meant to sort of channel Bechet.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Like, I couldn't play like Bechet if I wanted to.
How does Bechet play?
He plays like Sidney Bechet. He plays like, a black man that was born in America in 1898. That's right, 99.
We'll say the 1890s.
Okay, the 1890s. You know, who had this specific experience growing up in New Orleans and traveling through Chicago and New York and internationally and with a very specific temperament and dealing with the climate that was the United States in that time, so he plays like Sidney Bechet. I don't want to just imitate those licks and those sounds. Like, for me, that's not the important part about those Bechet recordings. The important part is this, like, energy and the spirit that he puts into it.
Mm-hmm. I would never have guessed that.
Really?
And I don't know why, but even though the nation has become more and more alike, you know,
yeah.
I mean, homogenized, I still see the American West as something different, something other. Life west of the Mississippi River is
yeah.
a different kind of life and promotes a different kind of sensibility.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So can you think geographically in that way and make an assessment of like how that space, you know, in any way influenced your musical perceptions?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I grew up in we moved a little bit as I was growing up, but basically in two places. One was coastal Northern California, and the other was the Rocky Mountains of Colorado. And it was rural places in both of those.
Was that Pacifica or
Yeah, Pacifica Moss? And Moss Beach, which
Moss
are
Beach.
Basically 10 miles apart from each other. In Pacifica, we were literally in a tiny shack. My parents were hippies, so we were in a tiny shack on the beach, and that was where I was born and lived until I was three. When there was like a flood surge, and the house got washed away, and then we moved to Colorado in these Rocky Mountains, which were, you know, you could see your neighbor's house, but it was quite far away, and so it was really like a nature kid with this feeling of expanse, and it's also a feeling of like perspective. If you could see my hands, I'm making these rolling motions. Because the Pacific Northwest is very rolling. There's bluffs, there's these tall, tall bluffs, and then this huge expanse of ocean, you know. So I think that landscape, but also culturally, I've had friends in college be like, what were you raised in a cave? And I was like, that's kind of accurate. Except for that we weren't necessarily really raised. We were pretty, or at least for me, I was the youngest of five kids. So at that point, it was just like you wandered out into nature, you know, and came back when you were hungry.
I mean, you're really talking about some of the most beautiful places in the country, you know,
yeah.
the Pacific Northwest and of course, the mountains of Colorado and all. I mean, what were your parents aiming for, do you think? In terms of like where they wanted to live, were they looking for beauty? Were they looking for what?
Yeah, I think again that's a slightly complicated question. And I mean, they were young parents. You know, they were East Coast kids. My mother grew up in Massachusetts and moved out to San Francisco in the late 1960s, and my father was in upstate New York and moved out to Greeley, Colorado, and then San Francisco. And so they met in San Francisco in the late 60s,
which was a time, I understand, to have been there. My whole family, I think of kind of as these like bird-like creatures in some way. They're like sensitive people. So I think part of that being in nature was wanting to escape an East Coast culture, I think. They wanted to have this thing that the myth of the West Coast offered. And yeah, I think nature, also they were quite poor. We lived in like a shack on the beach, you know, and we all shared, I think, two rooms. I was like 3-year-old, so I don't totally remember, but, And so I think that they never wanted to live in cities.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. That culture, you're really raised to like explore. My parents never gave us advice. There's plenty of times where I've asked for advice. I'm like, Dad, how does car insurance work? Or what do I do with this? You know? And he's like, I just want, you know, just live your life. Just be free. It's like, it really is a funny thing. I'm just like, there's a level of balance you can have here. And that's.
You can't tell that to State Farm.
Yeah, right. I never said that. But there is a level of like, for in that culture, being a child of the hippies in some ways, that is really just like, oh, explore the world.
Mm-hmm. And so what did they do for a living?
My mother is a landscape gardener and also taught piano when she was younger. And my father used to be in rock bands, I think kind of more before I came along. And then when he had to support a family, he started working for the National Archives. And then did that until he retired recently.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
So he's an archivist?
Yeah, he's an archivist.
Oh, man. Your folks seem very interesting.
Yeah. They're wacko. I mean, they're some of the most illogical people I have ever met. And I know probably everyone feels like they can say that about their parents, but it's not true. Mine have you beat.
Oh, my gosh. And so what did your house, what did your house sound like?
I don't have a lot of memories of my father at that age, at a younger age. And it's not because he was he ran away and didn't want to support the family. It was because we were quite poor. And so he would go to work in Denver and he would work during the day as an archivist. He would take a nap in the car. Then he would sometimes go to band practice, I think, and then work a night job.
Gee.
And like sleep over either in the place where the night job was as a janitor. And then he would wake up and work a day job again. So he was sort of the figure that he brought home food on the weekend. It was like, the food guy's here, you know? And you knew what day of the week it was by how little food there was. Like on Fridays, it was always like, I'm going to the neighbors. You know, it was that kind of experience. So there was a lot of instruments in the house always. And there were like kind of hand-me-down things. And there was a piano. And my mother, as I said, taught classical piano.
And what instrument did your dad play?
My dad actually played saxophone. I didn't hear him play it that much by the time I came along. But he played saxophone. He also sang and had a rock band. So he played some keyboards in a rock band and was like the singer for a band called Accelerator.
I love it. I love it.
Yeah. I think there was a lot of piano. My mother was a free improviser, although she would never call herself that.
Is there any particular song that when you hear it, you're like, it transports you right back to?
I mean, I think about, there's some classical piano pieces that my mother played and then I played that I learned to play
like
at time. Like the Beethoven Pathetique Sonata.
Ah.
For me, the Rachmaninoff Concerto in C minor was a thing, you know, Chopin. So those kind of remind me of home.
I love that.
You know, so I think those kind of recordings. Barbara Streisand. I know a lot of Barbara Streisand. And that is not because I've tried, but just it's in there. And I actually really love Barbara Streisand.
Moaning low, my sweet man, I love him so. Though he's mean as can be, he's the kind.
If sweet man should pass me by, if I die, will he be? He's the kind of man. He's the kind.
Of course, Babs. Yeah, and then actually, like, Stravinsky reminds me of my father quite a lot. Like, that, those are some of the few memories I have of him as a young child. Is like on Easter, for instance, we would in Colorado, we went to Red Rocks, and he had this old boom box that he brought, and he would like wake us up at dawn. And we were not raised religiously at all, but Easter was like a, for some reason, a special, that idea of this kind of like rebirth and renewal, and spring is coming. And he would like woke my brother and I up at sunrise. This is a thing. And he would carry this boom box, and then like we would just sit in the middle of nature, and he would play Rite of Spring.
Wow.
And that is the thing he also did another time when we lived in California, also on Easter, where we would hike up this kind of rolling bluffs on Highway 1 that looks out over the ocean.
Exactly.
And play Rite of Spring on this really crappy boombox.
Rite of Spring is this is not like pastoral, beautiful, you know what I mean, kind
right.
of serene music. This is like very challenging, scary sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, dissonant kind of music that freaked a lot of French people out
right.
when they first heard it, like at the beginning of the last century.
Yeah.
So, like, how did you interpret that as a young person?
I think this is a thing with music in general. As a young person, if you're not exposed to, like, this is good, this is bad, this is correct, this is incorrect, it becomes colors and experiences. I recall, like, kind of lying there and, like, you know, watching the sunrise and, like, hearing these stories, these sonic stories and textures, which really, I think, is, for me, the best way for music to be experienced.
Were your siblings the same, or any of your other siblings musicians, or like you?
No. And that's a complex question. My two older sisters are all artists and weirdos, I would say. That my oldest sister she's an ethnobotanist, like, she's a scientist,
mm-hmm.
basically, but she's also a brilliant, like, watercolor visual artist, painter. She paints these really kind of fantastical things. She's very, very shy. And my other sister is a writer, creative writer, writes a lot of short stories and poetry. So, yeah, those are my two brothers have passed. Both of them were musicians in.
Mm-hmm.
My own brother was quite young when he passed. He was 21, but he had, you know, gotten into guitar, and there was definitely like a lot of music in both of them.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's like you were really describing an artist colony,
yeah.
as opposed to a family. I mean, that happens where everybody happens to be related. You
yes.
know what I mean?
Yeah,
that's,
yeah. That's pretty
it.
Accurate.
Well, so when did performance become something that you were interested in?
I don't know. I don't have like a specific. I never had lessons growing up. And in fact, I recall like asking my mom
both asking my mom for lessons and asking if I could have piano lessons. And my mom's response was, if you really want to learn something, you're going to teach yourself, which is a strange response from a piano teacher.
It is, but thank God she's not a driving instructor.
Yes. True. Which goes back to a little bit what I was saying, like, my parents are some of the most illogical people I've ever met. But there is something to that, you know? So I don't have a point where I was like, oh, I wanted to perform. I see performance even in my relationship to music as secondary to just being able to make music.
Uh-huh.
You know, so I don't always necessarily like, I really want to perform. It's like, I really want to make this music. And it seems like performing is the way that it's going to get made.
Ai meu mister, que dinheiro cut la mer. Depuis bande outro jour, nous convoyons tout le loup. Tout le monde dans son nuit, mais tout le loup nous a pris. Depuis chasse au bord d'Oli, tout le loup, commodez-vous. Tout le loup, mi, tout le loup, aïe, aïe.
Tout le loup, mi, tout le loup, aïe, aïe.
En bas de mer, tout le loup, aïe,
aïe. Tout le loup, mi, tout le loup,
aïe, aïe. En bas de pied, tout le loup, caca.
Tout le loup, mi, tout le loup.
Et cacoui aussi côté.
Touloumi, touloulou, ayaw.
Touloulou, 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 ayaw.
Touloumi, touloulou, ayaw.
Mais touloulou, commandez-vous.
Touloumi, touloulou, ayaw.
Touloulou, 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 ayaw.
Touloumi, touloulou, ayaw.
En bas ses pieds, mon goût tout nuit.
Touloumi, touloulou, ayaw.
Touloulou, 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 ayaw.
Touloumi, touloulou, ayaw.
That's Aurora Neeland and the Royal Roses with Tulaloo. Coming up, if a color had hands and feet, how would it move? Stay with us. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. Composer and bandleader Aurora Neeland is our guest. We've asked her to pick up her saxophone and play anything. Why? Because she can. To write the scores that are in her head, Neeland had to learn to play any number of instruments at the Oberlin Conservatory of Music, including her computer.
Oberlin had this program called TAMARA, which stands for Technology in Music and the Related Arts.
Technology in Music and Related Arts.
And Related Arts. Mm. But in my case, it's not necessarily electronica in the sense of like, it's like, boots, 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 it's going to make
exactly.
These beats, which I actually really love that music. And
I must dance.
Yeah, I must dance.
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 Yes, exactly. Kraftwerking. So their program, actually, I was sort of drawn to the TAMARA program, which is also like tied into the composition program, mostly because I got to Oberlin and it was like a terrifying conservatory where other kids, students, had been like strictly studying privately at Juilliard Prep since they were like -2.
Wow.
You know, so it was like I was suddenly very much like, oh, I will never be a performer. Like, I don't have any of that training, any of that background, but I still really love music. Okay, I'm not going to be a performer. What can I do? And that's sort of when I was like, maybe I'll look into composing or this technology in music and related arts. Which is a lot of like, they start with looking at like musique concrète, which is like found sound, making compositions out of, sounds that you're recording out in the environment.
I love that.
And that to me felt very natural. It's like computer music, although I'm very much not a techie person. So my love for that music has lasted. My skills in that department have not totally lasted. But that's how kind of how I ended up there.
Yeah, through composition.
To them.
And so when did you pick up the saxophone?
The soprano saxophone I didn't pick up until I moved to New Orleans.
Oh, okay.
The piano really was the instrument I played since I was quite young. And then when I moved to New Orleans, that's really when I picked up the soprano saxophone.
Oh,
it was
okay.
Also lighter, and you could travel with it on a bicycle. That was like a kind of a thing. It was a thing, you know.
It's important.
Yeah.
The practical considerations, really. Well, you know, teach us something about the saxophone, if you could. You once said something about how it can be easy to begin as a saxophone player, but then when you're trying to sort of negotiate the moat between a good beginner and like a really proficient artist.
Sure.
You know what I mean? That there are these dangerous waters.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
And so can you demonstrate that for us a little bit? You know?
I mean, for me, to be honest, like a lot of that is intention. Like if you're, I mean, soprano is like, it can sound beautiful and also can sound like a dying duck, which I can demonstrate that.
How does a dying duck sound?
Oh, it's like, you know, like, like that, you know, like a dying duck.
Yeah, that is a dying duck. Like, you're right. You're right.
There's a level of like technique that's just about the flow, the airflow, and you're putting air through, you're vibrating the reed. You're also making choices about what kind of tone you want to be produced. And that kind of, for me, equates into like what kind of energy you put to the horn. Again, sounds pretty hippy-dippy, but it's true. So you learn as you get older to control the airflow, so you can do like, right, you have like a level of how you're controlling the airflow that you don't have as a beginner necessarily. I'm really interested in like putting these non-traditional textures into traditional music, right? So like, this would be technically a good sound, like, and this would not be as good, I think. Right, there's a different like texture,
yeah,
and intensity to
one
it.
Is sweeter than the other.
Yeah, one's sweeter than the other, and for me, those are both just colors, and that you can use as a palette to recite your poetry, basically. Mm-hmm. And so that's the interesting thing about saxophone for me, is like it can really imitate the human voice, which I secretly think is what we're just trying to do with most instruments.
Yes.
For me, I'm trying to create a voice with the sound, the limited sounds that this physical instrument makes, but creating a whole palette of voice.
Mm-hmm.
That is a huge part of teaching, is I really encourage the students to like, okay, we're gonna study like notes and rhythm and reading and tone production. But really, like, a huge part of what you should be doing is, like, going to a room where either no one can hear you, or a room where you are not worried about being judged or, like, wanting to play prettily or whatever, and, like, explore the sounds that you can make. This school brought me to Paris, really, this Jacques Lecoq school. I graduated from college, and then a lot of artists, theater makers and performance artists I admired had sort of gone through this Jacques Lecoq training, which is kind of like an experimental theater, physical theater school.
Right.
And I was really interested in like staging happenings in public spaces and sound installations.
Right.
And so the Jacques Lecoq school, it has a very beautiful trajectory of how you study like the physical body, how you study the body's relationship to space, a lot of, like, Julie Taymor had gone there, who's a famous
Oh, the wonderful director. Broadway director.
Yeah.
Yeah, she did, what, The Lion King?
She did that's what she's most famous for.
But
she's done a lot of very stunning design, beautiful work before. She had also gone to Oberlin, so I think that had this, like, I'm going to follow Julie Taymor's footsteps and become some weirdo artist that I'm not quite sure. And then when I went to Jacques Lecoq, I had a sort of disillusioning time there.
Why?
I think a lot of it is Jacques Lecoq had died 3 years previous to when I had gone there, and he really was the pedagogue of the school. But it then instead became very rigid, which I am pretty sure from reading the books and talking to other people that have gone to the school is not really how he taught, you know? I remember we were in one class, and the movement teacher was like beginning the class, and he would say, like, okay, everyone move like light blue. And so everyone in the class, you know, it's all dressed in all black. Everyone's moving in different ways. And because what is light blue? You know, who knows?
Right.
And the teacher then suddenly was just like, no, light blue does not move like that. Light blue moves like this. And then he does this like very specific motion, and then everyone copies him. And from then on, that's like how light blue moves. And I don't think that's how Lecoq himself would have taught that. I chose to not go on to the second year.
This song is called Bye Bye. Coming up, Aurora Neeland is going to her car. She's getting her accordion. This is going to be good. Stay with us. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out. Musicians often resist being associated with only one kind of music, but the multi-instrumentalist and composer Aurora Neeland resists more than most. She applies the same gusto to a Negro spiritual like Joshua Fit the Battle of Jericho as she does to surfer music. Here's her song, 111.
Danger, 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 danger,
danger, danger, danger, danger,
danger, danger, danger.
I don't always think of myself as like a singer. I'm not a singer. I'm like an instrumentalist who happens to sing. Anytime I'm teaching vocals, which is kind of strange because I'm not really a trained vocalist, like the biggest thing that I can teach really is you should try to sound like yourself. Like that's what, for me, those are the singers and the artists that are most interesting to me are people that just simply sound like themselves.
You know, I was listening to a radio story that a fellow named Jeff London did, and he talked about taking a class from Julie Stein, the songwriter. You know, he wrote so many hits on the Hit Parade and so many Sinatra hits and stuff. And so many Broadway hits like Funny Girl and, you know, Gypsy. Whoa. And so Jeff London had actually gone to conservatory and so he wrote a composition, you know, for his class with Julie Stein and played it. And Stein said, what are you doing? At the end, he said, what are you doing? We don't need to know you went to conservatory when we listen to this song. We don't need to know all your training and this kind of stuff. He says, write a damn song.
Yeah. I applaud that very much. Yeah.
And it was fascinating. He was like, you know, because he heard, you know, Stephen Sondheim. He heard, you know, I mean, Stein did when he was listening to Jeff's piece. You know, he heard all the people who, you know,
had influenced him.
And he's like, so I heard everybody else except for you.
Yeah. I think, I mean, that's an evolution any artist goes through, whatever your form is, whether it's poetry or song or composing or an instrumentalist, an improviser, you know, like it's you go through that infantile progression of evolution.
The mimicry.
Yeah, the mimicry. And then you, ideally, you also like start to kind of infuse things in your work that are coming from an outside source that are filtered through the Gwen Tompkins brain or filtered through the Aurora brain. So like, that you're producing work that is filtered through your own brain rather than mimicking. Yeah.
Well, tonight I'll sing my song again. I'll play the game and pretend. But all my words come back to me in shades of mediocrity, like emptiness and harmony. I need someone to comfort me.
One-woman show here in New Orleans at the Contemporary Arts Center, mm-hmm. in which you explored musically ideas relating to hysteria.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I was interested in exploring female hysteria in the historical context of it used to be a medical diagnosis that women could be diagnosed with up until the 1970s, I believe, 60s or 70s. I mean, what's interesting, if you read about like what the actual diagnosis meant, it covered everything that a normal human being would experience. You know, it would be like, you know, you're suffering from female hysteria if you experience like stress, fatigue, irregular menstrual cycles, normal menstrual cycles, like desire to have sex, too little desire to have sex, acting out, misbehavior. When the diagnosis was originally around, a lot of it was a symptom of society needed to control women.
Right, to control women's behavior.
Right.
And all that, in a way that could be legally binding.
Yeah.
Yeah, because once you diagnose, then after that, you know, people have the right to put you away.
Right.
This is a test of the emergency system. And it's only the age of test emergency.
No need. I think we definitely demonize women's behavior still more than men's behavior, you know.
But apart from gender, issues of mental health and madness and all that, these are real things. I mean,
yes.
You know, people, families are afflicted by these, you know, by these situations all the time.
And, right.
I mean, certainly in my family. And,
yeah,
you
my
know,
family. Yeah. I mean, for me, that it's a lot of what my work, I guess, has been shaped by it is like looking at societal pressures and wanting to sort of deconstruct what is underneath it. And a lot of that is because I had personal, my brother who was closest to me died when I was 17 and he's 2.5 years older than me. So it was kind of the person that I had been closest to. And he died after he had been diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. And this was also in the late 1990s. When there was much more of a stigma around like talking about mental health or talking about anything, I'm talking about medication, you know. So I think a lot of my view as a young person was definitely shaped by that. So it was called apparent suicide. We don't really know what happens, but he was found drowned in the ocean near very close to our house after kind of struggling with paranoid schizophrenia for like eight or nine months. So I think a lot of that female hysteria project, and certainly even the work on the monocle, is for me continually rooted in this like exploring our relationships to ourselves and our relationships to society and the world that is maybe not set up for all of us to be successful or be able to function.
I'm really sorry that you went through that. I'm just very sorry you went through that.
Yeah, and, I don't talk about it to be like, woe is me,
no.
But more that it really shaped it. I mean, that experience really has been probably the biggest thing that has shaped my life and world perspective, I think.
I will not fight, though madmen taught my heart to be. No, I'll fight myself. A memory made and mistook will bruise and heal. For I am under
I've felt very protective of sensitive people from quite a young age. And that even comes from when my brother was alive. He was just a very sensitive boy. And I was sort of like a, in some cases, a protective younger sister. So I think some of that is like wanting to validate people's authentic, their expression of themselves. Like it's important to validate this sort of you finding yourself and feeling confident in yourself and like making choices that are not always like, oh, I should look like this. I should dress like this. I should move in this social circle like this. And I should play music and art should be expressed in this way. You know, there does feel something important to me of like support original work and support people trying to find their own voices.
I love that. I love that, you know, and we've talked around your album, your latest album, mm-hmm. The Monocle, because one thing I wanted to mention, and this is interesting to me, you perform in a number of personas, a number of guises, sure. A number of identities.
Sure.
You know, most people in this day and age, they want to be on brand. They want right. You to always know I'm Beyonce and
right.
I'm Beyonce and at the Louvre.
Yeah,
I'm Beyonce doing the X, Y, or Z, but I'm always Beyonce, right? And all. Whereas, like, I mean, you're Jessica from a punk duo with Helen Gillet, the cellist, you know?
Yes.
You are, you know, I mean, you're the Monocle. I mean,
sure.
You know what I mean? The album doesn't say Aurora Nealand,
sure.
You know what I mean? Kind humankind. It says the Monocle kind humankind,
yeah.
Right? Of course, you're Aurora Nealand of the Royal Roses. You are in your duo with Tom McDermott. Mm-hmm. There's a character who looks a lot like you and sounds a lot like you named Rory Danger.
I've met her.
Rory Danger and the Danger Dangers. I don't know, you know, I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you, Gwen.
And all. And so, you know, I mean, why so many hats?
I mean, it really just goes back to like, what does the project need and what serves it best? I think some of it is like it is a confusing branding product, right? So I think some of it actually is a choice of like the Monocle is the Monocle and that's my original music and that is this style that people who want the Royal Roses for their, you know, wedding probably don't want Monocle music there. And so it's easier to say like, oh, did you want the Monocle or did you want the Royal Roses? I think Rory Danger, that project, whoever Rory Danger is.
Whoever that woman is, who looks identical to you.
Yeah, like that person is that person when that band performs. That's who that person is. And it's also like there's no one project that can encapsulate any human or performer. So
that's true. But, you know, with The Monocle, which is a fascinating album, you know, it's a concept album to a large degree, although we are not, as the listener, always privy to what the concept is in a flat sort of exposed way.
Mm-hmm.
But the album is like, it starts off with you saying, I shall not want.
Mm-hmm.
And there are these, you know, beautiful bells and all that, and then it goes into like songs that sort of talk about loss,
sure,
and time.
Yeah.
And so do you see this album as more of a statement on society, or do you see this album as a sort of a personal reflection of Aurora Nealand's experience on this planet?
I think it evolved. The album took a long time to record because it was just me, and like no one's paying me to do this. No one wants me to do it. There's no other person other than me who's interested in making this happen. So I guess that's the answer. Is that there's a couple layers of very, very personal things, and there's also some commentary about how I experience the world.
Well, so okay. If we promise to put a link to your song Arcade Lights on our website, mm-hmm. you know what I mean, so that people can hear how it sounds on record,
sure,
you know, and encourage the people, of course, to purchase it.
Sure.
And would you mind singing an acoustic version of that song?
Sure, yeah.
Okay. What's the song about? I just love it, but I don't exactly know what it's about.
What it means to me is maybe different. What it means to you, what it means to me, it's sort of a parable about this like hierarchy that we set up. And you know, I had like a period in my artistic life at one point where I think I was really searching for like a mentor and like this workshop is going to show me how to do the things that are inside me, or like if I take this class with these skills, that's going to show me how to do it. And then I was disappointed a lot. I mean, there's some ways that I would like learn some skills, but it was never like the right fit. And I finally had to sort of tell myself, like, no one is going to teach you how to be Aurora Nealand. Like, you're the only person that can teach you how to be Aurora Nealand. And so I had this thing, I would say, like, no more gods, Aurora. Like, there's no more gods. There's people that you can, like really respect and look up to, but they're not gods. They are them. Like, Laurie Anderson is Laurie Anderson. You're not going to be Laurie Anderson, right? Like, Brian Eno is Brian Eno. You're not going to be Brian Eno. Kenny Garrett is Kenny Garrett. Like, you know, like, you're not going to be these, and you can't.
Three little birdies sat on a tree, praying to heaven, glory be. Thunder, lightning struck below. They each wondered who'd be the first to go. Two little angels sat up on high, watching them birdies, oh, watching them about to die. One angel said, "Sister, will you forgive me? If I should fall to save those birdies three." Mighty God sat up above, watching his angels, oh, watching them fall for love. God, would he save them? No, not he. He struck down his angels for saving those birdies three. Does he get lonely on the Lord's day? God, will you miss me when I walk away? Will you remember when you can't find me? How you struck down your angels for saving those birdies three? When I'm gone, will you miss me? When I'm gone, will you forgive me?
Then there's the second half of the song, but
it's fabulous. Thanks. It's just a wonderful, wonderful song. Arcade Lights.
Yeah.
Aurora Nealand, I want to thank you so much for being with us. You've spent a lot of time here, and it's just been a real treat.
Thank you, Gwen.
I wish we could interview you every year, I have to say, you know.
Thank you for what you do.
Aurora Nealand joined us here at Marini Studios. Her latest album is the monocle, Kind Humankind.
And you've been listening to Music Inside Out. Our show is produced by Lynette Johnson, Garrett Pittman, Paul McDonald, Thomas Walsh, Justin Armstrong, and Lars Hoel. Music Inside Out is produced in partnership with WWNO. For more information about Aurora Neeland and a complete playlist of the songs in this hour, go to our website at musicinsideout.org. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out.
Major support for Music Inside Out comes from the Historic New Orleans Collection. Music Inside Out also receives support from the Ruth U. Fertel Foundation, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, the Pinkalope Foundation, Baba Jim Istanbul Studios and Mastering, Adam Newman Designs, Shop Nadine Blake, and WWNO. Donations to Music Inside Out are tax deductible, thanks to our partnership with National Performance Network. For more information about how you can support our program, please go to our website at musicinsideout.org/support.